Grant Wood's American Gothic was the equivalent of a platinum record or a best-selling novel. He went from struggling painter to superstar of the art world almost overnight. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll get to know the man behind the masterpiece. My guest is R. Tripp Evans, author of Grant Wood, A Life. Grant Wood began his life on an Iowa farm with a strict authoritarian father and a secretly sympathetic mother. When he was 10 years old, his world was turned upside down. We'll talk about how his difficult childhood shaped him, his inability to deny his true calling, his relationship with his family, his repressed sexuality, the evolution of his art, his remarkable body of work, and of course, his legacy. Join our conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. During his life, Grant Wood cultivated the persona of a simple farmer painter. His reality was not that simple. Today, we're going to find out about the man behind the paintings. My guest is R. Tripp Evans. He is author of Grant Wood, A Life, a new biography that's just been released. Tripp, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the very beginning. So this farmer persona that Grant Wood portrayed throughout his life, it started out as a reality. He was a farm boy.
Right.
And he was born on a farm outside of Anamosa, Iowa. Tell me a little bit about his early beginnings.
Well, Wood grows up for the first 10 years of his life on this farm outside Anamosa. And it, in a way, kind of imprints him for the rest of his life. I mean, it is those 10 years that he is constantly sort of coming back to in his life and in his paintings. So he really does grow up as a farm boy and probably expected as a young man that he would become a farmer. Certainly, it's clear that those were his father's expectations.
Well, and there were some very interesting family dynamics in Wood's family. Tell me about his father.
Wood's father comes across in Wood's own writings as a kind of, I can only describe it like an Old Testament God. I mean, he said that he was more God than father to me. An incredibly kind of strong and profoundly religious figure. He took a very dim view of Wood's interest in art. And, you know, Wood loved him, but I think that he feared him greatly also. And certainly there was some reason for that. I mean, there was lots of banishments to the cellar and those kinds of things. And, you know, even Wood's earliest art making was only undertaken under the kitchen table, hidden by the tablecloth, hidden by his mother. So you get a sense early on that the relationship with his father was a complicated one, to put it mildly.
But certainly authoritarian, and corporal punishment was also certainly a
right.
part of family life. You write about that space in the cellar where he spent time and when his father was punishing him, and that space under the table as really his first art studio. What began to develop there for Grant?
Well, I think from a very early age, and Wood says this himself as an adult, art was a form of escape for him. And so whether he was hidden underneath the kitchen table or locked in the family cellar, I think art became a cathartic exercise for him. And so he talks in a very kind of winning way about, oh, you know, these wonderful drawing sessions in the cellar or under the table. And of course, you're reading this thinking, this poor little boy, you know, hidden away in the darkness. But for him, it was a form of escape. And I think that artwork always was that for him.
He had two brothers and a sister. What was his relationship with his siblings like as a young boy?
Well, you get a sense that Wood, and his sister Nan says this, felt almost as if he didn't belong in the family until Nan arrived. He and his little sister Nan were, like twins together, absolutely very close from an early age. You don't get a sense of Wood's connection to his older brother, Frank, or his younger brother, Jack. It's almost as if they kind of disappear from the family story in Nan's accounts and in Wood's accounts. It's almost as if it sort of gets distilled down to simply just Wood and Nan and that family. You hear very little about those two brothers.
Well, let's talk about Wood's mother, because he had a very close relationship with his mother that became even closer after he turned 10 years old. In his early life, what role did his mother play?
In his early life, I think one of the reasons why Wood didn't have a super close relationship with his brothers is that he was considered something of a mama's boy. He and his mother, Hattie, had a very close relationship very early on. She included him in her gardening activities, and it really appears that from a young age, she was his greatest advocate in terms of his interest in art. I mean, the studio under the kitchen table is the best example of that. So in those first 10 years in Anamosa, his mother is really his greatest defender in a lot of ways, and the person in the family to whom he really connected most deeply.
And during that time, you write about the isolation of the family. I mean, Anamosa is a very small town. It was less than 2,000 people at that point, and they rarely went to Anamosa. This was their whole world on the farm, the six of them.
Right. Wood talks about their farmhouse. He said, I'm going to paraphrase here, but he said, we were as isolated as if we had been on an island in the middle of an ocean. And I think this is one of the reasons why the characters in his family become these archetypes that he goes back to again and again. Because of that isolation, the sort of majestic father, the saint-like mother, even the farmhand who lived with them, a guy named Dave Peters, who was a little bit of an ogre, kind of a scary guy, they take on the dimensions of demigods almost in his imagination as a child. And I think partly that's because of that isolation, and then become the stock characters of his paintings later.
What happened when he was 10 years old?
When Wood is 10, the event that sort of changes him forever occurs. His father dies very suddenly. And one can imagine, given his complicated relationship with his father, that however unconscious it may have been a form of relief for Wood. And yet it also engendered a kind of guilt about his father's death that lasted really the rest of his life. So when his father dies, when Wood is 10, it sets in motion a chain of events that really changed the Woods family. Woods family from that point forward, they moved to Cedar Rapids. He is suddenly able to pursue art in a way he had not been able to before. And he was able to have a much closer relationship with his mother and sister that he hadn't been able to sort of cultivate prior to his father's death.
He was able to draw on the top of the dining room table
instead
of underneath. But it also thrust them into really grinding poverty.
It really did. They entered a period of incredible economic insecurity from this point forward. In the early year or two after the father's death, the family is living in Cedar Rapids with relatives. Ultimately, they are able to kind of eke out an existence in Cedar Rapids, but the sale of the farm and everything on it only went so far. And Wood is working by the time he's a teenager to help support the family.
Tell me about some of those early jobs that he did, because even then he started dabbling in interior decorating.
Yes, as a 15-year-old, Wood gets his first interior decorating commissions in Cedar Rapids, and word spread. I mean, he was really making, you know, okay money as an interior decorator, painting murals. He did decorative metalwork, any number of things for sort of interior design. And this is sort of in line with the arts and crafts movement that, of course, he was very much allied with early on. But, you know, for a painter who later claimed, "I'm simply a farmer painter," farming was about as far from Wood's activities as a teenager as you can imagine.
When he was pursuing these ways to make money for the family and exploring his art, at the same time, there was this terrible conflict within him. What was his perception of an artist at that time?
Wood, I think, both due to his father's attitude and to his period's attitude, and maybe you can even say his region's attitude at the time, reflects a real sense of shame in a way that he attached to his calling as an artist. Artists in the late 19th century and certainly in the beginning of the 20th century were still very much connected to, I should say male artists, were very much connected to a kind of Oscar Wilde late 19th century notion of the effeminate aesthete. So there was a real sense of suspicion attached to any young man who wanted to pursue art as a profession. And Wood talks about this a lot in this early part of his life. You know, as a teenager, he says, you know, it wasn't considered manly to become an artist. He talks about his mother's father, his grandfather, saying that he should be ashamed of himself for even considering the idea.
And he was ashamed of himself.
He was. He was, and it's palpable in the way that he talks about this, and it's something that he never quite gets over, that sort of shadow, really, of his father disapproving of his calling.
The amazing thing is, with that internal struggle, it's astonishing that he couldn't resist his art. He tried so hard not to be an artist.
Right.
What kept bringing him back?
Well, at a certain point, he decides, all right, I'll be a craftsman. So in the 19-teens, he goes to Minneapolis and joins the Handicraft Guild under Ernest Batchelder, who was a leading figure in the arts and crafts movement. And I think he thought at that point, you know, craft is a little bit more manly than painting. So I'll be a metal worker. I'll be a cabinet maker. But of course, he ends up making, you know, decorative jewelry out there, which was, you know, seen as, you know, just as problematic as painting. And so you're right. He does keep coming back to painting. And I think largely he does because for him, artwork was, you know, painting especially was the way that he really worked out these, you know, kind of anxieties that he had, the way that he sort of dealt with people. And so he couldn't really escape it. And, you know, thankfully for us, he never did.
After he graduated from high school, he tried very hard not to be an artist. But then he ended up being an art teacher.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, when Wood serves a very brief stint in the Army, he never did service overseas. The armistice was signed before that. But when he comes back home from Fort Dodge, he was hired by Fan Prescott, who becomes a great mentor to him. She was a principal at the local junior high school. And he begins, you know, for the first time in his life, really kind of making money as a fine artist, not as a decorator, not as a metal worker. And he thrived in the school system. He loved kids. He loved teaching children. And they adored him. He was a very popular teacher. Fan Prescott often, you know, sort of tore her hair out about this Peter Pan figure that she called him, who was in some ways more like one of the boys than any of the other teachers.
Right. You write that she sometimes, although he drove her crazy, she also loved him and covered for him and filed his grades for him and did other things that he just couldn't do or wouldn't do.
Fan Prescott is one of many older women in Wood's life who kind of normally are the kind of woman who would not suffer fools. These are tough women whose hearts melted where, you know, Wood was concerned. So she had a real soft spot for him. So, yeah, I mean, she did things for him she would never have done for another teacher in the school system. And it's simply because she really felt like she wanted to protect him in a way. She was one of many mother figures that he had.
Well, we will talk more about his relationship with his real mother as well in just a moment. My guest today is Tripp Evans. He is the author of Grant Wood, A Life, and we are talking about the artist behind so many well-known paintings, such as American Gothic. And we'd love for you to join the conversation. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org is our email address. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we are talking about Grant Wood, the most famous artist from Iowa. Tripp Evans has written about his life in the new biography, Grant Wood, A Life. And just before the break, we were talking a little bit about Grant Wood's relationship with older women in his life. There were many women who sort of acted in that mother role to him, but there was no one he was closer to in the world than his own mother. And it is interesting because he took care of his mother. She took care of him. He financially supported his mother, and they lived together. But he had these two other brothers who married and had farms. Why did Hattie, his mother, live with Grant?
Well, It's an interesting question because Jack and Frank, the other Wood brothers, are such shadowy figures in all of these accounts. We only get the barest outlines of, you know, what these guys were like. But they really – they got out of Cedar Rapids very soon. In fact, Wood was left as a teenager really alone in the house with his mother and his sister Nan relatively early on. Actually, the brothers did not become farmers. They became mechanics.
Oh, pardon.
And so – but they took off.
Right.
None of the Wood boys became what the father had dreamed of, but they take off relatively early and marry, or at least Frank marries. So it would make more sense that Hattie, falling on hard times, would have moved in with someone like Frank, who was a successful car dealer. But, you know, for the rest of Wood's adult life and the rest of Hattie's life, they remain, you know, together in this living arrangement.
In some amazing circumstances, too. You put a picture of the shack that they spent one winter in. Tell us about that small shed, really, on Indian Creek.
Well, when Wood comes back to Cedar Rapids from Park Ridge, Illinois, where he'd been living for a year with a group of other artists, he comes back and Hattie's house had been foreclosed on in 1916. They really had hit rock bottom, and Hattie had hit rock bottom. Wood was penniless at this point, too. So they live in an unheated shack. I mean, it looks really about the size of a tool shed on Indian Creek in Cedar Rapids for a bitterly cold winter of 1916-17. And then eventually Wood builds a one-room bungalow for them to live in, where they lived until 1924. And in those years, the really grinding poverty of their situation necessitated that kind of living arrangement. Nan talks about the fact that they actually survived on things like baby food and the charity of neighbors. So we really are talking about desperate circumstances. But after 1925, once Wood really begins to sort of make money as a painter, he and Hattie continue to live not just in a single room, you know, but in pull-out beds alongside one another in his studio. So at that point, even though circumstances had changed, their living arrangements did not.
Wood did leave home a few times. You mentioned the time that he spent in Illinois. And mm-hmm. he also, as things developed, he developed a relationship with a patron, mm-hmm. David Turner.
Right.
And he also spent time in Paris.
Right.
So he did go out in the world, and he explored that artistic world of these large cities. What do we know about his life, for example, in Paris?
Frustratingly little, unfortunately. Wood spends, much of the 19-teens desperate to get to Paris. As a young man with real ambition as an artist, that was where he wanted to be. It's where any aspiring artist really wanted to be. So he finally sails to Europe in 1920, spends a summer there with his friend Marvin Cohn, and then manages to get back to Paris four more times in the 20s. In fact, at one point, he stays overseas for 18 months, the longest he'd ever lived away from home. He goes to, you know, Italy and the south of France. So he really spends a sort of extended time. We know so little about that 18 months. We have the accounts of some of his friends in Paris. You get the sense of Wood kind of tragically being a fish out of water in Cedar Rapids and an even bigger fish out of water in Paris. You get the sense that he didn't sort of participate in the kind of rowdiness of the expat scene in Paris. Having said that, he loved going back over to Paris again and again. And for him, I think it really was a kind of escape valve for him from Cedar Rapids. He would go back and live in this quiet way with mother in Cedar Rapids, knowing that Paris, you know, another trip was on the horizon at some point. So throughout the 20s, he almost has this kind of dual existence, Wood in Paris and Wood in Cedar Rapids.
You write quite a bit about Grant Wood's sexuality,
mm-hmm.
and this is something that there has been some debate about over the years, although you point to quite a bit of evidence that shows that he was indeed homosexual. Do we know anything about his life, his sexual identity and life during that period? Because in Paris, of course, in Cedar Rapids, there was not an open gay community.
Right.
In Paris, there was.
Right. In Paris, there was. In Paris, certainly would have encountered a community, even amongst the expats there, just you know, 180 degrees more progressive than anything he had ever seen before. The only hint that we get of Wood actually establishing a relationship in Paris is with a young man whose name kind of fleetingly kind of appears in the records, named Marcel Bourdais. He becomes, in the accounts of some folks, Wood's sidekick. They go, or they're sort of everywhere together. And he planned to bring Marcel Bourdais home with him to live with Mama in Cedar Rapids. And he claimed, you know, that Marcel would teach French in the public school system. There was something of an intervention when Henry Ely and some other sort of Cedar Rapids types were over in Paris and basically took Wood aside and said, you cannot bring this young man home with you. And to me, that's the closest we get to really having a sense of Wood's romantic life in Paris. But certainly there would have been many opportunities there, and also in Germany, where he travels later in the 20s, for him to have had a life that Cedar Rapids knew nothing about. Unfortunately, neither do we.
And that possibly is by his own design.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about his art during that period, because his early artwork looks very different from his later artwork. His early work would have fallen under the category of Impressionism. Mm-hmm. And although it's very skilled, it's not the striking kind of imagery that
right.
we see later on. But he really experiences an artistic epiphany in Germany. What happened?
Right. Wood had painted for nearly 20 years as you say, a very accomplished impressionist. The problem was there were lots of accomplished impressionists in his generation. And when he goes to Germany in 1928 to oversee the manufacture of a large stained glass window he designed for Cedar Rapids, Wood began to explore a line that he'd begun to sort of develop before going to Germany. And that was a kind of much more hard-edged, realistic style. In Munich, in the Alte Pinakothek galleries, he encounters, not for the first time, but certainly for the first time that his eyes were really open to them, the painters of the Northern Renaissance, the 16th century painters of Flanders in Germany. And he talks about this great epiphany of saying, this is really how I want to paint now. A lot of critics, even in Wood's own day, kind of scoffed at this idea of a sudden epiphany and a change in style. I think we can take Wood at his word in terms of how kind of blown away he was by these canvases. Certainly, it changes the way that he works forever. He comes back and he never again really paints in that kind of loose impressionist way that he had before Germany.
He also seems to have had a personal epiphany in Germany where he decided, I am Iowan, I want to live in Iowan, I want to be Iowan, and I don't want anyone to suspect anything
right.
about me. What is the image that he tries to project when he comes back to Iowa? And he calls it a return from Bohemia.
Exactly. It's interesting. Wood goes back and forth to Europe throughout the 20s. He never vilifies Paris or European kind of artistic culture until he comes back from Germany. And it is this absolute clean break. He says, I have come back. I will never go back. I am an Iowan, I'm an American, this is sort of my identity. Of course, this is also, Wood talks about this from a later date, talks about that break from a later date. I sometimes wonder if American Gothic had not been the spectacular success that it was in 1930, if, the trips to Europe might have continued. I think that once American Gothic defined him in 1930, he couldn't go back. He became the guy who was seen as untrained, which was, nothing could have been further from the truth. He was a classically trained artist and someone who was a Cedar Rapids small town boy. That was his brand, if you want to put it cynically, from that point forward. So, yeah, I mean, he makes this incredible kind of break post-Germany and never looks back. And from that point forward, becomes defined as the farmer painter.
When he came back, the first portrait, I believe, that we see, there were sort of two defining portraits mm-hmm. that were in this new style before we get to American
right.
Gothic. And one of them was a portrait of John B. Turner, Pioneer. Mm-hmm. And we're not entirely sure when that one was painted.
He
changes the date
right,
on it, though.
He does.
And then also this portrait of his mother, a woman with plants.
Right.
What do those pictures represent?
Well, when Wood paints a portrait of John B. Turner Pioneer, who was the father of his landlord, he experiments with a very new hard-edged style. This is right before he goes to Germany, so it shows that he really was thinking along these lines even before his epiphany. When he comes back from Germany, he paints his mother's portrait. Again and again and again in interviews, he says, "The portrait of mother is what got me started on everything." Of course, it's inconvenient that there was also this other painting from 1928 that is painted in exactly the same way.
So he changed the date.
Well, what he does is, ingeniously, he puts an oval mat on it to hide the date that he had painted on it for 1928. And until the 1980s, until that mat was removed for cleaning, the story had always been, oh, John B. Turner Pioneer was later than his portrait of his mother. The portrait of his mother was, that was the start. And of course, that's the story, that's the narrative that Wood wanted to tell. You know, it all began, you know, his rebirth begins, who else with, but with Mama.
Right. Well, we'll talk more about that in a moment and of course, get to American Gothic. We have a couple of callers on the line. Doug is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
My wife's great aunt was head of the art department at Iowa State and helped somehow with Grant Wood's studio when he came back. And we have a couple paintings that he signed and subscribed a note to her. And one of them is that Shetland pony or horse in the corner of a field. I think it was done with just charcoal. But we also have Christmas cards and letters from him, and his sister sent the postcard that she posed for and wrote notes to the families back and forth.
Oh, great.
And to my father-in-law. So I never really cared for his paintings, and a lot of them were in some of the schools, but it's a little interesting now because I heard the earlier interview when they were telling the story about Grant Wood's changing his lifestyle, but interesting subject, and I'm glad our family got a little touch of him because his Mrs. Bud in Ames has some of those paintings too.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you so much for calling, Doug.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, and the caller, you know, makes a great point, which is that I think that you know, what I'm hoping to do with this book is to demonstrate that Grant Wood and his paintings are so much more interesting, I think, than he's been allowed to be. And hopefully people will look at his work with fresh eyes at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah. In education, growing up in Iowa, we learn about Grant Wood, but in many ways he's been homogenized.
Right, right.
David is on the line from Chicago. Hello, David.
Yes, hi.
Hi, what's your
How
question?
You doing?
Good.
My question involves Grant Wood's adoption of overalls as a sort of a costume, since he wasn't really a farmer. And I'm wondering if this adoption of something which might have been construed at the time as being sort of like a more masculine image was somehow tied in with his efforts to hide his true sexuality.
All right, David.
That's a great question, and in fact, you know, yes, it's absolutely linked to that. We can actually pinpoint from beginning to end when the adoption of the overalls happens. Wood starts to wear overalls as his uniform when he's painting at the J.G. Cherry Dairy Processing Plant in Cedar Rapids. He'd been hired to paint promotional or to make sort of promotional illustrations for their factory brochure. When he is on the plant floor, a lot of people don't think about this today, but industrial workers wore overalls in the 1930s. So Wood adopts the overalls to kind of blend in with these guys, and he kind of never takes them off. He wears them as his uniform until 1935.
And he really derides painter's smocks as being effeminate. And
It's very much connected to that idea of the stereotype of the painter as a hopelessly effeminate aesthete. So he avoided, you know, berets and smocks and goatees like the plague, and he wanted to be seen really as a laborer, as a worker. So, you know, the overalls did that for him. And from our vantage point, we might think, oh, well, you know, lots of folks in Iowa were all walking around in overalls. The truth is they weren't. You know, unless you were a factory worker or a farmer, people saw this as kind of an affectation on his part.
And one that he stuck to, yes. to really firmly as well. Well, let's talk about American Gothic.
Mm-hmm.
How did American Gothic, he had painted this portrait of his mother,
right,
and he had painted this portrait of John B. Turner,
right,
in this new style, and American Gothic followed. How did it come about?
Well, he painted the portrait of his mother in 1929 and gives it to his mother as a gift, and the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art offers to buy it. Wood adamantly says, you know, absolutely not. This is a gift to my mother. And the mother says, eh, sell it. We need the money. You can always reproduce it. So I believe that American Gothic begins with Wood's attempts to reproduce the painting he had painted of his mother. And it's also my belief that his mother was the first choice for his model for American Gothic. He talks about the model he had chosen kind of backing out. He replaces the model with his sister Nan and then dresses her in the exact costume and accessories that his mother had worn in her 1929 portrait. So it's clear as a bell that he is sort of substituting Nan for his mother, even dressing her up as his mother in this painting. And the male figure in it, the model for it was his dentist, Byron McKeeby. But I believe that he's really much more of a stand-in for Wood's father. Wood never painted a straightforward portrait of his father his whole life. In fact, it was one of his deathbed wishes to paint his father. But we see Merville Wood, his father, kind of looking through the mask of these sort of stern types, like the man that you see in American Gothic. So American Gothic was a very complicated family portrait when Wood conceives it in 1930. He certainly was not thinking in terms of national themes at that point. He was a state fair guy. He was not a painter with a national profile. It's only after American Gothic has its sort of spectacular debut that he and the painting come to be seen as a national portrait.
We will talk more about American Gothic and the life of Grant Wood in a moment. My guest is R. Tripp Evans. He's the author of Grant Wood, A Life. We're finding out about the man behind the masterpiece and so many other paintings today. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we are talking about Grant Wood. My guest is Tripp Evans. He's the author of Grant Wood, A Life. And just before the break, we were talking about American Gothic, which is the painting that really put Grant Wood on the map. How did people respond? There was a showing in Chicago.
Right. It was entered into the annual American show at the Art Institute of Chicago, and Wood had shown there before with no real critical response. It was recently revealed by Stephen Beale that the painting was initially rejected by the jury. American Gothic was rejected and then put back in the show by a trustee who sort of got a kick out of the painting. It not only was the hit of the show, but it really made Wood not just into a national, but even an international figure. I mean, it was reproduced in Berlin and London. This was not a slow rise to, critical acclaim. It was overnight for him.
Anne is on the line from Cedar Rapids with, I think, the classic question about American Gothic. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Many people believe that's husband and wife, but I've always been told in any art classes that it's father and daughter. So which is it?
Well, I'm going to probably annoy you by saying it's partly true in both ways, but mostly you are right. Wood insisted that it was a father and daughter. But because there was that last-minute substitution of the model, it seems clear that his mother was the first choice for a model who would have been a much more age-appropriate model for the much older kind of male figure in it. When Wood substitutes his sister in his mother's place for this painting, the age difference kind of required that the relationship between the sitters change. So Wood talked about them as a father and daughter. What is interesting, though, when he was initially, kind of correcting critics' mistakes about the painting early on, the only thing he corrected them on was by saying, they're not necessarily Iowans. They could be anyone. He didn't correct them that it was a married couple. It was later that he began to really insist that it was a father and a daughter. And it makes sense if you think about the male figure really standing in for Wood's father. This is really a painting of his father and his sister. To make things even more kind of strange, Wood also referred to his sister in this painting as his maiden sister. Nan had actually been married for 6 years at this point. So it's almost as if he's projecting back and thinking about his sister at an earlier age, and certainly his father. So
even though Nan did spend some of her marriage living with Woods and his mother. So
after the marriage,
some
so the simple
things.
Answer is it is a father and daughter, but it certainly is a complicated issue where the models are concerned.
Well, Anne, I'm sure that's clear as mud now. Thank you so much for your call. And after he became this internationally renowned painter because of American Gothic, of course, he's still himself. He's a man who you actually describe as sort of being arrested in development at age 10. He has this helplessness about him, one of the things that makes a number of older women sort of take him under his wing. But now he's famous, and
right.
He has money for the first time, and he has power for the first time. How does he use that?
Well, I think that it overwhelmed him a bit. I think that the exposure that American Gothic lent him was in one way the thing he'd always wanted. He'd wanted to really make it as a painter. And it's kind of a cautionary tale about answered prayers, because I think that initially he isn't quite able to sort of take in the kind of profile that he's suddenly been thrust into. And, you know, a great example of that is, you know, Wood's first blackmailer, you know, appears within weeks of American Gothic's debut. So he knows that this is both good for him and dangerous for him as well in terms of his exposure. But he certainly, in interviews and in speaking with critics, is reinforcing this notion of being a simple farmer guy. And certainly, as you mentioned, too, he had a personality that was sort of childlike in a way, almost infantile in its helplessness. I mean, he sort of lost his keys, never knew when to show up for anything, you know, failed to pay his bills. And people took care of him, I think, partly because by seeing Wood as a child, they didn't really have to deal with what everyone in town knew, really, if you look at the accounts, that he was a closeted homosexual. I think people thought, if we think of him as a 12-year-old, we don't have to deal with...
And he's asexual.
Right, he becomes asexual, right.
And Doug is on the line in North Liberty with a question about this period following American Gothic. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I am curious on your comments on how the founding of the Stone City Artist Colony in the early 30s related to his newfound fame and his collaboration with other artists. I'll take my comments off here.
Thanks a lot for your call, Doug.
Thanks. Well, Wood's founding of the Stone City Art Colony, 1932, was really the realization of a long dream. Wood had attempted to create artist colonies several times before that, with some measure of success, but certainly not on the scale of Stone City. But you're absolutely right that with the kind of muscle that he had after 1930, with the kind of national profile that he had, he was able to establish a much more kind of extensive artist colony, and did so partly with a Carnegie grant, too, that he was able to, you know, sort of fund it through. So I think that, you know, the founding of Stone City Art Colony is a perfect measure of the way that his success allowed him to do a lot of things that he'd always wanted to do, but never really had the funding or the profile to support.
But it's another wonderful example of this sort of arrested development. He lost money on the Stone City Art Colony. He insisted on continuing to pay for it, even though they were sort of hemorrhaging money.
Right.
And it was kind of like a summer camp to him.
It was, and it also reflects his almost inability to sort of get himself out of those first 10 years of his life. What does he do the first moment that he, you know, decides to found an art colony, but to situate it right next door to where he had grown up? Stone City and Anamosa are very close, and in a kind of deserted town. At this point, it was really more of a ghost town than a thriving community, and one that had really flourished in the 1890s, really in the period of his boyhood.
I want to talk about the landscapes that Grant Wood painted. After American Gothic, he sort of had this amazing dichotomy, if you look at his work, with this realist work that American Gothic typifies and these amazing portraits of people. And then he painted these landscapes that so many of us are familiar with, like Young Corn and many of the others, that are, they almost look like fantasy landscapes. of Iowa. That seems like such a strange contrast.
Well, critics noted that, too, from the very beginning. Wood, when he exhibits American Gothic at the Art Institute in 1930, hanging right alongside it is Stone City, which he had painted many times long before he started an art colony there a couple of years later. Stone City and American Gothic could not look more different from one another. They really look like the work of entirely different artists. And for Wood, that divide seemed to have been an important one for him. The kind of grim realism of portraiture that you see in American Gothic in the Portrait of His Mother could not be further from the kind of joyful escapism that you see in his landscapes. And, you know, I believe that one made the other possible. Had he not had that kind of sense of escape or release in these fantastic landscapes, I don't think he ever could have sustained the kind of focus that the realism really required for him.
Let's talk about his marriage, because this, of course, comes fairly late in his life. Midlife is what he thought then, but yeah, it turns out to be quite late in his life. He married a woman named Sarah Sherman
Maxson,
and this was a very sudden development.
It shocked everyone who knew Grant Wood. In 1935, Wood's mother, Hattie, was really entering her final illness. Her health had not been good. She had always been Wood's greatest shield against marriage. She always told everyone, "I can't marry while mother is still alive." Well, suddenly mother was dying, and you get this sense of, oh, no, what now? Well, what now was a very sudden marriage. Very few people, unless, you know, outside of Wood's immediate circle, knew that he was even engaged. He marries Sarah Maxson in March of 1935. Neither Nan nor Hattie attend this sort of quick surprise ceremony. And not long after, Hattie does die. And it shocked Iowans not just because everyone considered him a confirmed capital B bachelor, the way that he was written about, but also because Sarah was a good deal older than Wood. She was gray-haired, matronly. She was a grandmother when they married. And she looked rather uncomfortably like his mother.
His mother does die shortly after the marriage, and his wife takes care of his mother on her deathbed, where Grant would not go.
Right.
They move to Iowa City.
Right.
He's teaching at the University of Iowa. What is his life like in Iowa City?
Wood's move from Cedar Rapids to Iowa City, I would say, was about as an abrupt a change in his life as the move from the farm to Cedar Rapids when he was a little boy. He was absolutely at sea. I mean, suddenly he'd moved from the town he'd lived in since he was 10 and the support system that he had there. He was married, a role for which he was, you know, terribly unfit. He had moved to a new sort of large home in Iowa City, and he was teaching at the university, where he had colleagues who deeply resented this sort of famous people's artist being sort of injected into their ranks. So Iowa City was a very difficult change for Wood. That 1935 moment of marriage and Hattie's death and moving is one from which, you know, many of his friends believe he never quite recovered.
And he really loses his drive in many ways. He has some amazing flashes of brilliance still, but he's not turning out a lot of paintings.
He isn't. He hits a patch. Early on, Wood had been very prolific between about 1930 and 1933. After his marriage to Sarah, you see a period of almost 5 years. He's only married for three, but certainly during their marriage, he really only produces one major work in 3 years. Things slow down for him painfully in those years, and he turns to other media. He turns to lithography and illustration, partly because I think he finds it almost incapable. He's incapable of painting in those years. He really hits a kind of block after Iowa City.
When he's living in Iowa City, he surrounds himself with young men. Mm-hmm. That he is very close to, and some very strange relationships there. One of the young men is his wife's son,
right,
who actually continues to live with Grant Wood after the divorce for a time. He and the son and his wife lived with Grant Wood, and that's a relationship where Sherman, the son, really kind of takes advantage mm-hmm. of Grant Wood's affections. There's also his relationship with his personal secretary or assistant, Park Renard. What was that relationship like?
Well, the minute that Wood moves to Iowa City into this grand new home with his wife, almost immediately, Park Renard, who was hired by Doubleday to help Wood with the writing of his autobiography, and he becomes really a personal secretary, he moves in with Sarah and Wood. So from the beginning of his marriage, Park is really a part of not just his professional life, but his domestic life. It is clear that Wood fell hard for Park Renard as soon as he, you know, becomes a part of his life. I'm still not sure if their relationship really was ever a romantic one. I think certainly it was on Wood's part. It is the deepest relationship he really had with a man for, you know, the last 7 years of his life. And certainly I think Renard, even if it wasn't reciprocal, knew exactly sort of the kinds of feelings that Wood had. And certainly, you know, Wood's colleagues at the University of Iowa and others in Iowa simply assumed that theirs was a relationship. Sarah talks about it in no uncertain terms as like the worst decision she ever made, allowing him to move in with them.
Well, and you mentioned that people in Iowa City assumed that Grant Wood was gay.
Right.
But there was also a whispering campaign. There was an investigation on the part of the people, the other faculty members at the University of Iowa, to get him ousted because of this.
Right. What happens is that from the beginning of his time at the University of Iowa, Wood's departmental colleagues really wanted to find some way to have him removed from their ranks. And I think that the, you know, the gay issue became that way for his department chair, Lester Longman, who, along with Horst Janssen, another colleague in the department, began a whispering campaign that turned into a would-be Time investigation. Time magazine sent reporters to talk with folks in Iowa City about Wood's private life. It was only through the intervention of the University of Iowa administration that the story was kind of squelched. But Wood really spends about 18 months desperately trying to keep this from getting out. And indeed, really until Joni Kinsey, who teaches at the University of Iowa today, wrote an essay about this in 2005. It was the first time anyone had ever really published minutes of those meetings. So before that, it was always seen as, well, there were teaching disagreements. This was the source of the controversy. Until Joni Kinsey was really able to publish that, you know, we didn't really know the nature of the problem.
Would There was some shuffling at the university to make this go away. And he was reinstated. He was feeling great, or he said he was feeling great about, you know, this is going to be the most productive period of my life. I'm going to paint. I'm going to teach. And then he gets sick.
Right. Wood concludes this 18-month battle with his department chair and with Time magazine and the university. In the summer of 1941, suddenly the clouds had passed. His dealers in New York were planning a major retrospective of his work. They were planning a major lecture tour. He came back to the university with his own department, free from Lester Longman. And he does, he gets sick. He's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer that fall, and it was very rapid. And what happens is that the major retrospective that had been planned by his dealers becomes his memorial retrospective in the spring of 1942, or I'm sorry, the fall of 1942.
Well, there is so much more that we could talk about, but we are out of time. My guest today has been R. Tripp Evans. He is the author of Grant Wood, A Life. Thank you so much, Tripp.
Thank you very much.
And Tripp is going to be appearing at Prairie Lights, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. He's also doing a tour across Iowa. You can find out about all of the places he's going to be visiting and reading on the website grantwoodalife.com. We'll put up a link to that on our Twitter feed. We'll also put a link up to that on our Facebook page as well. Again, that's Grant Wood, A Life, and it's a fascinating read. If you have the time, I highly recommend it. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at all times at our website, iowapublicradio.org. And of course, you can send us email, suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, comments at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, the Hort Gang is back. We're going to talk about green roofs, and we're also going to answer your questions about your yard or garden. Talk of Iowa's production of Iowa Public Radio News.